Certainly, we do live in extraordinary times. The 2020, I saw somebody who said they hope that 2020 is just not the trailer for 2021. They thought, oh, you know, that would be awful. Wouldn't that be awful? You know, one of the things that, you know, I'm kind of a novice student of history, mostly American history, but I've been actually looking at European history a little bit lately because a friend sent me a couple links to some things that he thought I would find interesting, and I just find that we just kind of live over the same thing over and over and over again. That's why history is so important to learn. And certainly, as I've been reading these great men and women of the middle of the 1800s of the United States, especially in the 1850s leading up to the 1860 and the Civil War, and how divided everybody has become and how difficult it has become. I know it's projecting kind of feelings back into it, but it just kind of has that feeling today. You know, as I'm reading, I can just feel like I can empathize and sympathize of what was happening there. But one of the nice things is that in those extraordinary times, some ordinary people became extraordinary in their impact on the nation. I mean, Frederick Douglass, Frederick Douglass, who was born in Maryland on the Eastern Shore, and then here in Baltimore, was in Baltimore and escaped. And he went when he escaped and went north, he just an ordinary guy, just a slave who wanted freedom, but yet he had such a passion to free his people that he was he became this major force to be reckoned with. He talks about in Baltimore, as he was learning how to read, he came across the word abolition, and he said it was like a thunder strike, you know, within a thunderclap in his life. And that word just gravitated, you know, he gravitated to that word, and he just kind of internalized it. And so here, a slave who has very minimal education became a great man, intellect, writing amazing things to try to help free his people. Abraham Lincoln, by all measurements, was very, very kind of mediocre. You know, as he was in his early life, had some businesses that failed. Was self-taught. Was a pretty good lawyer. Became a politician, served in the state senate, then he became a U.S. representative for one term, lost that re-election, and then went back into his law practice. Now, early on in his politics, he was kind of divisive. I mean, there's cases where he would make fun of his opponent to such a degree that the opponent would start to weep because people were making fun of him. But while he was away and learned, you know, as a lawyer, that the best thing a lawyer can be is kind of a mediator to bring peace, he started seeing the need for that. And then when he reemerged into the political world in the 1850s, he was trying to bring sides together, you know, trying to help people to stop so much hate. And as he became a president of the United States and helped redefine that we needed a new union and not the old union, a new union where everyone is free. You know, he was trying to mediate that also and try to show grace. So there are these amazing people that really, when you look at them early in their lives, very ordinary, but then they became extraordinary for the extraordinary times that they lived. And so today I want to talk about this, an extraordinary time in the moment of Christ and his disciples. Last week we looked at the Last Supper in the Gospel of Mark, and today we're following right after this. Jesus had instituted the Lord's Supper. He had told them that one of them was going to betray him. So they're all like, well, is it me? Is it me? You know, trying to ask questions, John and Peter kind of clued in that it was probably Judas. It's going to be Judas. And so now we come to Jesus going and praying. So if you have your Bibles, like you'd open up to Mark chapter 14, verses 32 through 42. Then they went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." Now, Gethsemane is just a word. It means press, basically. Probably, we don't know the exact location of Gethsemane, but it's most likely at the lower part of the western slope of the Mount of Olives. And so Jesus has now gone out. They've finished their Passover meal. He had said he would be betrayed. He said that they would fall away. You know, and Peter's one that said, "No, I'm not going to do that." And so he took Peter and James and John along with him. So he's had the other disciples sit down. He's chosen Peter, James, and John to go along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed. And he tells them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." Now, it's interesting that he took Peter, James, and John, and just before this, when he separated them before, and the last time he separated them, Andrew was with them. But Andrew's not included this time. And, you know, we kind of think these might have been the inner circle, but there might have been also a little bit more reason to take them. For instance, what I just mentioned is what Peter had said when Jesus said that everybody's going to fall away. In Mark chapter 14, verse 29, Peter declared, "Even if all fall away, I will not." So he is telling him he's going to be faithful no matter what. "You can count on me." Earlier in the Gospel of Mark, when James and John came and asked if they could be on the right hand or the left hand of him when he comes into his kingdom, Jesus responded this way in Mark chapter 10, verse 38. "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup that I drink from and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with?" And they said, "We can." And Jesus is looking at them and said, "Well, you will drink from it." So when he talks about the cup and the baptism, he's talking about his suffering and his death. So let's return back to Mark chapter 14. And it tells them, so he's taken them and he began to be greatly, deeply distressed and troubled. And actually the words here is that, you know, that he's very agitated. Now, when we read about the Jesus with the disciples, now we have seen times that he's been agitated by things. We've seen times that he's been angry. But he's actually saying he's so distressed, so troubled, that his soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. And actually, that it carries the idea of being horrified. So he's telling them he is so overwhelmed with what's on his mind that it's killing him. You know, that it's just, you know, it's actually robbing him of life. Now, they have been with him for 3 years, and there is no indication in Scripture that he's ever said this to them. So he is telling them about what is happening to him. And what we are seeing here is the emphasis of the humanity of Jesus Christ. Because we need to remember, Jesus is both God, fully God, and fully man. And we also know it from the Bible that he was tempted in every way that we were tempted. So right now, he is overwhelmed with the thought that's before him. He is afraid about the betrayal, the arrest, the trial, the torture, the crucifixion, and his death. All of that is overwhelming to him. And they are not cluing in. And he tells them to stay here. and to keep watch. Then verse 35, going a little farther, he fell to the ground and prayed. Now, in the ancient world, most of the time when people prayed, they prayed standing up with their hands up in the air. Unless they were overwhelmed with grief or sorrow or lamenting. And here Jesus is lamenting. And he falls down prostrate onto the ground, face down. And we see in Jesus, and Mark is given this picture of the perfect servant to be an example to us. And we see Mark throughout his gospel kind of paints that Jesus was a person of prayer. At the beginning of his ministry, when Jesus was baptized and tempted, and he picked his disciples and he went out and he preached the gospel, and then he was healing. And in Mark chapter 1, verse 35, it tells us that very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he needed to pray. He needed to be alone with the Father. And then in Mark chapter 6, after he fed the multitude, he sent the disciples out on the boat onto the lake, and he says this: after leaving them, he went up to the mountainside to pray. So both of these encounters is after a major event in his ministry. The prayer that we are seeing here, his priestly prayer, as some refer to it, he is in the garden and he is praying, and he is in the midst of what is happening. The betrayer is already out making the final preparations for the betrayal. He knows it's coming. He's overwhelmed, and he's praying. Now, Mark only gives us a little bit about the prayer of Jesus here, because his emphasis isn't about the prayer of Jesus. It's about the disciples and their reaction. But let's take a look at what Mark does give us. So going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. Abba, Father, he said, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. There's a lot going on in this passage right here, these couple verses. The first thing we see is that he refers to God as Abba, Father. Now, it wasn't uncommon for the Jews to refer to God as Father, but they would never refer to him as Abba, Father, because that was too intimate. Abba, Father carries the idea of daddy. You know, it's what children would call their father in Israel. And actually today, they still, whether they're children or adults, they refer to their father as Abba. You'll hear that every now and then. Sometimes if there's a Jewish character on TV, like on NCIS, Ziva David would refer to her father as Abba. So they still use that term as a term of affection. So here Jesus is demonstrating his intimacy with the Father, with his Heavenly Father. And he affirms that he is omnipotent, that the Father can do anything that he wants because everything is possible with him. And then he asks, take this cup from me. He doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to go through what he's got to go through. He doesn't want to suffer on the cross. He does not want to die. Now, that's his humanity speaking. And what we see here is his humanity being brought into alignment, perfect alignment with his divinity. And then he tells us, and he goes on, yet not what I will, but you will. He's saying, this is what I desire, but God, ultimately, my desire is whatever you think is best. Now, sometimes people will say, well, why is he asking God to change his mind? Is he really trusting God here? Well, yes, he's trusting God, because he trusts God enough that, first of all, that he has this intimate relationship with God, that he believes that God has compassion and is going to hear his request. That God is such a being that he does care about what we think and what we want. But then he goes on and he says, but you know, it's not my will. It has to be your will. Now, when I was a young person in my teens and in my 20s, I heard a lot of people, and I hear it once in a while, people would tell you when you pray, you just need to ask with boldness. Never put on that if it's your will. And I used to think that was odd. And I would debate these people. And they say, oh, no, when you're asking God to heal somebody, he said, well, then God, if it's your will, if you will do that, all you're doing is you're relinquishing your faith. You just need to name it and claim it. And I said, well, what about Jesus in the garden? Because he's actually doing, I want this, but it's okay, whatever your will is ultimately. Because he knows that what God has in store, no matter what, is perfect. You know, if God wills, he could deliver Jesus from all of this, or he can deliver him through all of this. You know, as I have four children, they're all adults now, but at some time, on all four of them in their lives, they've either had a major surgery or a minor surgery. And each time, there is some anxiety for them to go into surgery. Usually, the younger they were, the more anxious they were. And so I would tell them, I would try to comfort them, I would try to encourage them, But they would usually say, I just don't want to do this, Dad. I don't want to do it. I don't really want to do this. Now, one of my sons, he had trouble with that. None of his baby teeth wanted to fall out. So his permanent teeth were coming in, but they were coming in out of the sides of the gums. And so the dentist said, he's got to get like six teeth pulled. So he needs to go to an oral surgeon. I said, fine, we'll go to the oral surgeon. And he was a little anxious about all that. He was young and very nervous. So we went to the oral surgeon. And I said to the oral surgeon, I said, you know, I'm pretty sure I need to come back there with him to kind of keep him calm. Oh, no, that's not what we do. We'll take him back there. He'll be fine. I went, I think I need to go back there. Nope, everything's going to be fine. I said, okay. So about 15, 20 minutes later, they come out. I'm like, wow, are you done? He goes, you're going to have to bring him to the surgery center. We can't do it here. I said, well, wait, why can't you do it here? He says, well, we can't even get him out. You know, we can't get the mask on him. He won't let us. He's fighting us. And I'm like, okay, you should have let me come back there. So I go to the surgery center. Yeah, a couple weeks later, we go to the surgery center. And I say to them, do you want me to come back there? Because we had this problem. Oh, no, we can handle this. This is great. No problem. So I'm sitting down in the waiting room, and about 15, 20 minutes later, out they came, and they went, come with us. You'll have to come back. So I go back in their little surgery suite, and they said, you got to talk to him. We cannot even. He is scrambling, crying, moving, fighting us. You just have to talk to him. I went, oh, I'm not talking to him. I'm holding him down. So I get over and I put my arm over him, pull his arms down, put my hand on his head, and he's looking into my eyes going, Daddy, don't, I don't want to do this, Daddy, I'm scared, Daddy, I'm scared. And I'm hearing every word and my heart is breaking. But I'm not letting him up. Why? Because this is what's best for him. So I'm holding him down, and I'm telling you, you talk about heartbreaking, they put that mask on, and he's there telling him to breathe. He's not breathing. He's going, Daddy, I don't want to do it. Daddy, no. And out he went. And then, I don't know, 35, 40 minutes later, they say, well, you know, you can come back in a few minutes. I come back, and he's like, when are we really going to do it? I said, you're done. He's like, oh, really? But I heard him. But I wasn't going to change the plan. And God hears us. This is the example. God hears us. But it doesn't mean he's going to change the plan. And really, when you look at this passage, you know, there's times where God announces, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." There is no indication Jesus got any message. It's just silence. Then, verse 37, then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. And he said, "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour?" So he singles out Peter. Why? Because Peter was the latest one that said, I'll do whatever I need to do with you. I'll stand by you through thick and thin. And notice, I love how he says in Mark, and remember, Mark is probably writing from Peter's perspective because Mark was an aide, was a co-laborer, a co-minister with Peter. So he's writing what he learned from Peter, and Peter says, yeah, he told me, he said, "Simon, are you sleeping?" And Mark writes, "Simon," he said to Peter. You know, isn't that interesting? Not Peter, "are you sleeping?" But Simon, he said to Peter. Simon got the name Peter when he confessed Christ as the Messiah, as the Christ. And Jesus said, "Your name is going to be Peter," meaning rock. "And upon this rock I will build my church." So he's talking about his confession. But here he doesn't call him Peter, he calls him Simon. So apparently Simon has kind of reverted back to his old habits. He has returned back to his old way. And he was asleep. Now, let me just say, we can cut the disciples a little bit of a break here. It's easy to condemn them, but let me just share one thing, kind of bring this in perspective. You know, when we have Thanksgiving meals, and you do all the prep, and you have the big meal, you gorge yourself, and if you drink a little bit of wine, maybe that, you know, little wine in the system and food on the belly, just like the disciples had just experienced. Big Passover meal, they had some wine, it's late at night, and it's out in the outside in the cool of the evening, and it's dark, and they fall asleep. Okay, I understand. I mean, do we stay awake after Thanksgiving meal? No. We don't. Even the people who do the Black Friday shopping usually takes a nap before they go out, right? So we can understand how they could be they could be tired. But here he has reverted and he just wasn't watching. And that just means to stay, not just to stay awake, but to stay alert, to pay attention to what's happening around him. You know, as I mentioned, I read a lot of the biographies about the middle 1800s. And, you know, I haven't really used Ulysses S. Grant as an illustration for a while, so let me just use him. Early in his generalship, he came under a lot of criticism for the Battle of Shiloh. They were caught by surprise. And the Confederates came in early in the morning, drove the Union forces full run, driving them all the way back to the river. Grant actually got men moved around to slow that advance. Actually, a very brilliant tactician. You know, he would fight and pull back to slow them down because he needed nightfall. Now, everybody thought nightfall when he's... And they did get pinned onto the river, and they thought, well, he's just going to evacuate us. He says, oh, no, we're going to reinforce an attack in the morning. And then they actually won that battle. But the first day, it looked hopeless. And people laid the blame at Grant, but I'll tell you, it was General William Tecumseh Sherman that we laid the blame for that. And I'll tell you why. Sherman's pickets were out in the woods, and the night before the Battle of Shiloh began, and they're out there, and they notice a rabbit, you know, run right past them. And they're like, huh, wow. And then another rabbit ran past them. And then rabbits were running past them, and other wildlife running past them. And they went, something must be going on. So the pickets walked out and saw the Confederate Army gradually moving through. So they went to Sherman, and they reported, Confederates are moving through the woods towards this position. And Sherman told them if they ever gave a false report again, he would court-martial them and to go back and do their job and maintain the pickets. Completely ignored what they said because it wasn't even in his mind that that could be possible because the Confederates were not that close by. So while Sherman was having breakfast the next morning, all of a sudden everybody's running, and he had abandoned his tent, and one of the officers of the Confederates actually sat in Sherman's tent and ate his breakfast. He wasn't watching. He kind of reverted back to still that peacetime mentality. And Jesus goes on and tells them that, you know, have to watch and pray because the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. So we have to constantly remind ourselves that we need to bring our humanity into our divine calling as Christ followers. And recognizing that there's going to be times we're going to be horrified, there's times that we're going to be afraid, and we should be willing to go before God and be honest about that because he already knows we're terrified and afraid. And we are okay to ask him for what we desire as long as we understand it has to ultimately fall within his purview. And then it goes on. Once more, he went away and prayed the same thing. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes are heavy. And they just didn't even know what to say. So they were tired, they were caught. They had no excuse. They could not explain anything. They're still not picking up on the very fact that he is upset, that he is overwhelmed. One of the things that I learned by being in the hospital so often with my kids, they said that they told us that we should never get nervous unless the doctors and the nurses get nervous. If they're calm, you stay calm. And so I tell people that when I go to visit them. If they get nervous, that's when you get nervous. I've been in the hospital room when they get nervous. That's not a good place. But usually they're pretty calm. So they still were not picking up on this. And it goes on, returning the third time, he said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? They just did not get it. And we look at this, and how ridiculous it is for him to be so traumatized, so overwhelmed, that they just sleep through it. Does that sound like anybody that's there for you? Does that sound like anybody who's in tune with you? Does it sound like anybody who actually really cares what you're going through? And who would do that? Now, this kind of reminded me of a passage out of Mark chapter 4. So it's just after Jesus' teaching and leaving the crowd, the disciples, took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling, but he was in the stern asleep on the cushion. And they woke him, and they said to him, Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Oh, wait a minute. This sounds similar, doesn't it? Now, We probably weren't so willing to give the disciples a pass, but I bet we're willing to give Jesus a pass, right? Think so? Isn't that interesting? They fell asleep while he's distressed, but earlier he fell asleep when they were distressed. So what's the difference? Well, it goes back to the whole thing about the doctor and the nurses. When they're nervous, you be nervous. Jesus wasn't nervous. Everything was under his control in Mark chapter 4. There was no crises. They allowed it to become a crisis. He knew that they were perfectly safe. There was no harm that was going to come to them. So he could sleep because everything was under control, even when it did not look like it. But in the passage of Mark 14, Jesus is willingly giving his life, but in a moment, it's going to be turned over into the hands of sinful man. And once that is cast, all those events are going to be driven by just how evil man could be. So returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough! The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise. Let's go. Here comes my betrayer." So he's telling them, "Are you still sleeping? Well, enough. The time has come. The hour is upon us. It is here." He's about to drink the cup of God's judgment, the cup of his suffering. And he says that he's about to be delivered. Let's go. And he's not talking about let's run away. He wants that we're going to meet them head on. We are going to approach them, not just them approaching us. We're going out to meet them because it is time for the time of redemption. It is time for Christ to suffer on our behalf so that he could rescue us from an empty way of living. It is time for him to die on the cross so that we can come to him in forgiveness and be forgiven of our sins and rescued. And what we see here is an extraordinary time that really requires extraordinary obedience. And that's what we see in Jesus Christ. An extraordinary time that is happening, but yet he demonstrates an extraordinary obedience to the Father. "God, I don't want to go through this. Father, I don't want to experience this. But whatever your will is, I am okay with it because I will do it because it is your will." And in the extraordinary times that we live in today, and we are living in extraordinary times with a pandemic that is going on, with the protests that are happening, with the election cycle that's happening, and the public shaming that keeps rising up, with everything that is happening, and even it's not just happening in the United States, there seems to be unrest that is sweeping the planet, and we recognize that. You know, just as things get bad, it seems like every month something new comes along. I mean, China's even said they have a few cases of the bubonic plague. I'm thinking, China, stop telling us things. Just stay there and stop telling us things. And they, there's just all this stuff that keeps mounting, and we keep seeing it. We live in extraordinary times, and as Christ followers, we are supposed to be able to speak into this and try to bring hope into this and to speak peace into this and help people to see what there are the realities that are happening, and that requires extraordinary obedience from us. We can't just revert back to our old selves and our old way of habits. We need to rise up and to really embrace Christ in the things that we say and the things that we do. And that requires that extraordinary obedience so that we can influence those around us for Christ.